Very dear Roland Barthes, the drama of language as a mad discourse reminds me of a fragment you once read in your work Lover's Discourse, as you criticize Goethe when he utters, after his stupidity, "Just finishing rereading Werther, not without irritation, I had forgotten how long it took him to die, which is not at all the case. He keeps going on and on until you want to give him a push right into the grave, 4 or 5 times. What you had hoped was his last breath is followed by another, even more ultimate one. The extended leave-takings exasperate me." Goethe indeed does not realize the necessity of time. Werther plays a double part in this drama. He is the contempted and victimized individual body as well as the hero who escapes, albeit through that. Of course, such dying takes time, as most readers would probably not become aware of the height of such an act, would it have been contemplated in a single sentence. Goethe doesn't realize you speak, that in a novel of love the hero is real because he is created out of an absolute projective substance in which every amorous subject collects himself, and that what he is looking for here is a man's death, is my death. I have wondered whether Goethe's irritation, which seems to come from contempt with sentimentalism, is not simultaneously a fear of being regarded as stupid, a fear of being excluded from a general discourse which creates such a safe haven of durable and absolute boundaries between life and death, excluding the process of dying as well as of excluding pain. Maybe you should not be so hard on Goethe. Sometimes it seems amazing to me how difficult it must be not to be lured into such pre-discursive framework. I've read your work, most of it, mostly all of it, with a growing respect of such daring undertaking. You have given a decisive outlook on intentionality, though it might not take very long for science to incorporate you in its body of texts. I hope it will not succeed in such an operation, but the epistemological circumstances are such that linguistics and psychoanalysis have become increasingly interdependent. Whether or not theories of Lacan will prove to be a consolation to some, already it seems that you will inevitably be drawn into the play game of words, as soon as intentionality of your writing will be reflected as a structuralistic approach of an exclusively mental operation. Otherwise, not unthinkable, the presence of the body as being part of the text will probably draw you into the body discourses of Merleau-Ponty and his followers. There will indeed be enormous amounts of attempts to make your work part of one form of rationalization or another. I remember you once wrote, reflecting on a photograph taken of you, "I am interested in seeing my eyes only when they look at you." But for you, imagine, to be incorporated in a general language would probably imply that you look at your own eyes by looking at a loved one and then realizing that this loved one turns out to be an insane madman. It reminds me so much of Soren Kierkegaard, who one time wrote on philosophies which are dispersed of internal life that they are the most inhumane form of insanity existing. So much so that one does not even want to look such a madman in the eyes, to find his eyes to be of glass, and to find him to be a spurious product. It is a good thing you did write an autobiography, and as a matter of fantastic possibility, your displacement between the object and the subject, the application of the ye instead of the I, might prevent your work from becoming part of them and those. I hope it can be prevailed. The present state of fashionable discourses is one in which the writer ceases to exist as being and becomes a subject of the totalizing glorification of those, them, who lack a genuine literary language. Though this is a harsh judgment from a political point of view, it could also create a space for a genuine possibility of emancipation. It resembles what one of your contemporaries, Marguerite Duras, once said about the writing of women. That is, the writing of women is really translated from the unknown, like a new way of communicating rather than an already formed language. But to achieve that, we have to turn away from plagiarism. In fact, for feminists to be writers, it takes a more individual approach that has little or nothing to do with feminism. And this, I might add, counts as well for any other political group construction, be it of body, mind, gender, or ethnicity. The bare nudity of the discussion between essentialists and constructivists is a factual extension of the older body and mind discourses, and it upholds the separation in biological or cultural terms as a scapegoat for political action. Between the body, the mind, the gender, and the ethnic discourses, of course, there are other possibilities, less obvious. One might be a more existential one, which views, like Kierkegaard, that the existential individual is at the same time object and subject. But this would not in itself be enough to develop as a translation from the unknown, as Marguerite proposed. Within the individual body, as a mere perception, as such, there is a nameless space which is neither object nor subject, which unknown, which oneself, but which equally does not write, as you said. To write on oneself may seem a pretentious idea, but it is a simple idea. As simple as the idea of suicide. Again, it seems similar to the heroic death of Werther, but it never fails to be the subject of irritation or fear at the same time. It has always been called pretentious for that same reason. Whatever would happen if people truly did take control of their life, that is, what would happen if people did truly write oneself? A general fear within society seems to disengage individuals to do so. Lord knows, most scientific theories simply rule out the possibility to write oneself forehand. The psychological or linguistic entity, which is such a pleasurable object of social science, has been for long described as incapable of modifying its surroundings. Language is an excellent device to positively confirm that, albeit general idea, but a text is capable of more than many scientists make us believe, that is, it is capable of socially intervening, as you wrote once. The social intervention of a text, not necessarily achieved by the time the text appears, is measured not by the popularity of its audience or by the fidelity of its socio-economic reflection it contains or projects to a few eager sociologists, but rather by the violence that it enables to exceed the laws that a society, an ideology, a philosophy establishes for themselves in order to agree among themselves in a fine surge of historical intelligibility. This excess is called writing. Between you and Marguerite, a space has appeared, an individual space which makes such a social intervention possible. It is, to say the least, a space nevertheless at the expense of great pain and desolate imagination. For such a text to be created, its writing has to be fully disconnected from any recognizable object, on the one hand, and simultaneously needs a fully objectified imaging, on the other hand. Such a text could never do without the entire spectrum of existential human being, as but part of that spectrum would immediately lead to the incorporation without evocation at all. No text seems capable of achieving this. Only the individual author can. And therefore, both the author's pain and imagination are of direct bearings for its final outcome. Yet, exactly these elements called pain and imagination are the subject of contempt in scientific text, or overbearingly exaggerated in literary text, except for poetry, which is frequently contempted for its textual destruction and its primitive Aristotelian linguistic structure of representation. We have little else available but desire, that modern concept which now seems to dominate all discourses. As such, desire took up both place and role of what used to be called civilization. Desire reflects the desirable outcome, not a coming out. Desire has indeed become the intermediate between the inexpressible pain and objecting imagination. Desire is the mirror which reflects on either side. It is persistently important to question this twofold mirror named desire, as it reflects both the sensed and the unsensed within Western society. But it reflects, as any mirror, never exemplifies or represents neither pain nor imagination. In fact, desire laughs at both, as it is just only or solely desire. Its status as a mediator exists, eats, breathes, and strives on its imaginary content. Desire, quite frankly, spells doubt between the sensed and the unsensed. Indeed, to speak or write from within the pain and the imagination, like both you and Marguerite did, is daring, even suicidal, as it is doubtful and suspect and leaves the reader without conviction, without possibility of becoming convinced by the author's intentionality. Such uneasiness in reading causes both pain and imagination on the part of the reader, as he is thrown back into the domain of his own bodily perceiving to find no recognition, if such a space happens to be shamelessly empty. Not able to find in oneself neither pain nor imagination, leaves but to feel contempt over the irrational desired perception of other bodies. Both terms are equaled through yet another general concept, which is called eroticism, in the sense that you described it. But what is eroticism? It is never more than a word, since practices cannot be so coded unless they are known, in other words, spoken. Now, our society never utters any erotic practice, only desires, preliminaries, contexts, suggestions, ambiguous sublimations, so that, for us, eroticism cannot be divined save by a perceptual, elusive word. A word, then. Not a movement, not a perception, but a word. What emotives, what moves, what retains, what in itself, outside the communication of the word, pain and imagination on either side, and in between lays the lover's discourse. No wonder that lover's discourse has been received as a text in despair. I feel, in spite of all speculation, that the proximity of one's own body has been completely overlooked in the interpretations of both you and Marguerite's writing. To accentuate this proximity, it is important to at least attempt to view the perception of both pain and imagination on the individual body. This is a counterpoint from the point of view in which this individual body becomes hopelessly incommunicable, inexpressive, irrational, yes, that too, of course, in love or in doubt. Writing should cease to be individual imprisonment, but what to do and where to go and how to remain individual? That is a matter of pain and imagination.